This went on for some time, accumulating tools and material, and he wanted to sell out to us. Well, we couldn't afford to buy. We didn't want him to leave, because he had really been a dad to us. But he'd go back next summer, and the same thing was repeated. So he comes back, and he insisted on selling out to us. Well, we still wanted him to stay on. So there's a large area in the back of the old store where he lived, and he was there for security, and anytime we wanted to go there, we had keys for the place, and we just had access as it belonged to us. So we didn't want him to leave. So in the meantime, since he felt we wasn't going to buy, he didn't have much business judgment. He's big-hearted, but he found a young man that was willing to buy at a bargain. He was going to sell to him at a real bargain. Well, this young man, Thomas, the buyer, he just bought everything that was there, ours and all the old man. He didn't realize that what we had wasn't to be sold. Well, Thomas took it for granted that he buy the place, he gets everything was there, all of the material and tools and everything that we'd accumulated, he got everything. So we went down to one evening to try to catch up with the workers. We're a little bit behind for opening tomorrow, and our keys wouldn't fit. The locks had been changed after we'd left to go home for supper. So my brother, he was a big husky guy, and he broke the door in and got in, and Thomas was in there. So they really looked like they were going to tear one another apart. And the old man was in the back. He runs over next door, and there's a young lawyer by the name of Paul Brindle was keeping the desk at the YMCA that particular evening. So Paul runs over, and he runs between them and says, "Hey, hey, you guys are not dogs. Says dogs fight. You're not dogs. Why don't you close up here and go home, pray over this thing, and come back tomorrow and act like human beings?" So he finally got us separated, and that's what happened. We got the door where we could close it and went home, and next morning we come in. We got the president of the YMCA come over, and he just listened to what was going on. So he finally decided the case. He says, "We know these boys, that they're good, honest boys, can be trusted anywhere. We don't know this fella, Thomas." Says, "If the old man wants to sell out, we will rent to the rent to the boys, but we will not rent to this other guy. So if he wants to take what he can buy and he can go somewhere else, that's his business." So that ended the deal. It left us in position to buy or a walkout or whatever. As the old man, he was determined he wanted to sell. So we were left in a position that we didn't just know what to do. But we had some wonderful customers that just thought the world of my brother Howard and myself. Since we had gained by the help of this old man, he was a real watchmaker. He knew every piece of a watch and exactly how every piece should be adjusted and so on. And he had, if we didn't get everything just right, he let us know about it. He'd bawl us out from time to time to be sure that our work was done in the way that it should be. But there were three dignified guys. Mr. Marvin McNeil worked at the White House. Ronald Patrick, he was an attorney, government attorney, office around the corner from us, and Mr. Ansel Walker, he was head over Indian reservations out west. He had about 500 men working under him. Well, each of these men, they had fine watches. They would actually race them against one another, see who could come within 1 or 2 seconds or whatever, more or less, over the other fellers. So they'd come in. Every day at lunchtime, we had a Western Union clock that was hooked up to the, our regulator clock was hooked up to Western Union, and it would zero every hour. You could turn the second hand and the minute hand off time, and when the hour come, you get a strike one, and it would zero exactly right to the fraction of a second every hour. So at lunchtime, these folks would come in and check their watches, see if they'd gained a fraction of a second or lost a fraction of a second or whatever. And they were so proud that we were keeping those watches in better repair and running closer than they'd ever known them to run. So we talked to them about our situation. Well, even before this, they was so close friends to us with no education, no natural education, they did our corresponding for us. We had bought a Monroe calculator, which if you push the right button, you get the right answer on any type of math. So we could use that thing. We could take it apart and repair it, being mechanically minded. We had no problem with our math. So these fellas did our correspondence until we got where we was able to take care of it ourselves. So my brother and myself talked it over. Says, in the frame of mind we're in, we might not treat that old man right. At the same time, we want to be treated right. So we put it in the hands of these three dignitaries, and they didn't make any charge. They got together and figured out how much we should pay, the amount of payments and all of the terms, and drew up the contracts and everything with no charge. So they fixed it in a way that we could buy the place. And the old man, he'd go back to Switzerland where he come from. So just before he got ready to go, in fact, he stayed over about another 6 months after we made the deal before he got ready to go. So there's a man by the name of Edward Durick come in, and he spread a paper on the counter and said, "Hey, Mr. Frischneck, sign this paper for me." This guy, the old man we referred to, his name was Edward Frischneck, F-R-I-S-C-H-K-N-E-C-H-T. Very unusual name. But anyway, Durick come in, he says, "Mr. Frischneck, sign this paper for me." Well, he didn't look to see what he was signing or anything. He started to sign it at about a 45 right up across angle across the paper. He says, no, not there. Sign down this line. So he signed down on the line, didn't realize what he had signed. He'd signed a note for $1,800. At that time, was a lot of money. So Durick took this note by Frischneck's reputation down to his bank and cashed the note. So when pay time come, Durick made no effort to pay the note. So he left the co-signer to pay it. Since Frischneck was gone, and his property that he had sold stood for the note, according to what we understood it. So we got subpoenaed for the note. And the same day that we got the subpoena to go to court, there's a bill collector come in to collect some back bills, which was an understanding between Frischneck and ourselves, that he had some money was to come in. Well, since he'd be gone, we would collect that. Then we would pay his outstanding bills, such as doctor bills, dentist bills, and such like. So the money that's owed him about equaled what he owed. Well, we were going to take care of that when it come due. So this bill collector come in at the time when those bills come due, and we just paid the bills right up. And he says, "This is unusual." He says, "Everywhere I go to collect bills, says I got an argument or a fight, or sometimes I've got to go to court to collect." I say, "Here, you guys just pay it like you was willing to pay it and owed it." Well, I said, "That's the situation. We owe it, and we want to keep the record straight." Well, he says, "Since you're such a nice guy," says, "if anything I can do for you anytime, says let me know." Says, "My business is fighting to try to collect what is due people." My brother Howard said, "Well, maybe something you can do right now." He goes back to the office, and he got this subpoena. Says, "We got this morning. What should we do about it?" Well, he says, "There's always a loophole in these things." Says, "If you just study it real careful, and if you're smart enough, you'll find a loophole in that where someplace that it is not sound. Says, it's made by human beings, and human beings not able to make things completely sound." So we had told him the story about the old man staying over for about 6 months after we had bought him out, and then we was able to get up a little extra money. So we paid him some money in advance before he left, and we told him this story before he left. He says, "Let me take this up to the office and start it over." He says, "I'm sure there's some place in here that we can find a question." So he took the paper. About a half an hour, he called back, and he says, "You guys said you'd pay the old man some money in advance." We told him, "That's right." Well, he says, "There's your loophole." Said, "This thing had about 40 questions. It started at the top. There's part of the first part, or part of the second part, any money? If so, how much, and terms, and so on." He says, "Where it says part of the first part, or part of the second part, any money? just put N-O and sign it at the bottom. Don't answer any question. When it goes to court, then you can answer these things to come do where you won't be argued against. So we just, when party, the first part, O party, the second part, any money, we just put no and signed it and sent it in. But when it come up to court, I had a very intelligent judge. It was a woman judge, but she was very, very intelligent. And this guy had a bad reputation. Frisnick's reputation had been very good. We were trying to defend his reputation. She saw through the whole thing. And she told this fellow, Durick, says, you don't even have a case. Says, you beat your way through every way, and you depend on your co-signers to pay off your debts. Says, you just don't have a case. Says, case dismissed. He was very unhappy with that. So he takes it to another court. We had several courts in the area of Washington. So he takes it to another court, and so happened that a good old granddad type of a judge there. And when he looked these papers over, he says, it looks like this has been in the hands of Judge Kading. So she's one of the most intelligent lawyers we have in the state, in the city of Washington. So I'd like to refer this back to Judge Kading. She understands the case, and it's new to me. When it went back to Judge Kading, she really bawled this guy out, because she knew what he was to start with. So he didn't bring it up another time. We had many experiences in the store. One particular case that comes to my mind right now was every 6 months there would be a notice sent out to all the major repair shops for repairing government clocks particular and some of their extremely fine instruments. So we would get this notice, a blank to fill in as a bid, blank to bid on this work every 6 months. We never did bid because we felt we was getting a sufficient amount of work from the street to keep going. We had a very dignified fella, name of Frank Bourne, as a customer. Well, we just knew him as a very fine man, as Mr. Bourne. Well, he come in every once in a while and says, why don't you guys bid on this work? Says, I know you'd get the job. He kept telling us how he knew we'd get the job. Well, we didn't question who he was or how did he know so much. So one morning, opening mail, we found our bid had been accepted, and we hadn't bid. Come to find out, it was signed by Frank Bourne. It had to go through his office to be okayed. Whoever signed, he had to okay the contract. So this, he'd filled out our form and signed it, Frank Bourne. So I went to his office for the first order. We had a little Chevrolet van cushion up to haul clocks. Went down to his office for the first order, and he sent me to the Capitol to get a load of clocks. They had scads of them down there, and many, many offices throughout the Capitol building, private offices, had clocks that belonged to the government. And they'd had people bidding on these clocks. They'd take them in and bring them back without repairing them at all. We could find this out by some of the clocks they'd just paid to be repaired, and there was cobwebs in them. They'd never been taken apart at all. Well, we determined that our work, as we had a reputation doing work right, we're going to do the work right. Well, we kept that contract for many, many years. Regardless of what other people bid, they never did take it from us. It finally got to where our business grew to where we had to give it up on our own after many years. But we kept that contract and doing these clocks in these various government buildings for a long, long time. But the Capitol building was one of the buildings that we had to go once a week, go through all these offices, and we got paid for each trip for winding and regulating clocks, and anyone needed repair, take it out and repair it and bring it back and put it on the bill. So this went on for a long time, but we finally had to give it up on our own. All during World War II, we worked long hours at the store to try to keep things going. Well, you couldn't get qualified help during that period of time. But there was a period of time we had at highest 8 watchmakers employed. It was my brother Howard and myself. We were owners of the place. And Brother Will and Baines, our brothers, they come in as employees. We all 4 worked together for a long time. Then we had four other watchmakers that picked up work and took it to their own shop to work as a sideline. So they had eight at one time supplying work for eight different watchmakers at one time. But after watches and clocks went electric, that cut out the majority of all watch and clock repair. But during this period of time, we got so worked down that we wasn't doing 5 days' work in a week. And I had a strong desire to go to church, but we were working 7 days a week instead of going to church. We finally cut out our 7 day work and started going to church. And to our surprise, we found we were doing more work and better work with better judgment how to spend our money by taking off and going to church and resting up over the weekend was doing in 7 days. So we got along so much better. So we went to church every Sunday. We didn't have a church in this area that had church every Sunday at any particular church. But a different church where we go to different churches and go every Sunday. The Washington Church, the Bethel Church, the Columbia Church, and the different churches in the area, we could go to church every Sunday. Well, I'd had a desire as a youngster to follow my Lord in baptism. But during all of the activity, that kind of got cold. But after I started going to church, it come back. I had a strong desire to ask for a home in the church. I never talked to my wife about it, but I felt very much convinced. So at the time of the Catoctin Association at the Manassas High School, I went and sat through the association about the third seat back from the stage, about the center of the stage, all the way through the association. To close the association, I felt so impressed when they gave an opportunity for anyone that wanted a home in any of the churches of the association come forward and make their wishes known. Well, I got up to go, and my wife, she followed me. We had never talked it over. I knew she was qualified. Somehow or another, I didn't feel qualified, but I had a desire. So we were received in with a wonderful fellowship. I hope I never forget it. It's one of the greatest days in my life. Well, I've heard people say that after they had joined the church, that they felt maybe they'd done the wrong thing. They get down in the dumps, so to speak, about maybe they shouldn't have got themselves involved. That wasn't true with Jim Compton. I felt it just seemed like he just grew better and sweeter all of the time. In less than a year from the time we had joined the church, how we'd been going for some time and got pretty well known, less than a year from the time we joined the church, they called me to the office of a deacon. I tried to get out of it, because I knew a deacon's job was more than passion bread and wine or a collection plate or whatever of this type. That there's some work to be done, visiting the sick, try to do the things that is helpful to the church, especially the poor and the needy. Well, at our little church, we had a couple, Brother James and Jenny Priest, who had been in an automobile accident years before, got horribly crippled up, wasn't able to go to church, and almost to the point of starvation. So we visited them a few times, and we brought the findings back to the church. Such a horrible living that they had, just almost a starvation existence. However, they had a good doctor, Dr. Meadows. He was the family doctor, and he had a particular feeling for these old folks. And he'd tell the neighbors around, says, if you got something you don't use, that you can't use, James and Jenny Priest don't have anything. They could use any help that you could afford. Same way with the undertaker, Mr. Barbie. He would take word around and tell the folks. So we found these things out and brought the word back to the church. Elder T.E. Majors was our pastor at the time. So he asked the church, says, you know what you're supposed to do in a case like this? Well, the church desired him to tell us. It's my duty to tell you. Said, you should send a committee and investigate this case, and whatever is necessary, the church is obligated to act on it. So they sent the deacons and the pastor, which I was just a newly ordained deacon. And on the way up, Brother Herman Alderton, very fine deacon, wonderful member, but he didn't want to hurt the feelings of anybody. He says, it makes me feel bad to go up here and interfere with those old folks' business. Says, they feel we're trying to pry into their private affairs. I said, Brother Herman, I believe if we go in the right attitude, that the Lord blesses in our efforts. Well, we got up there, well, even James was blind had a real good sense of humor. And I could see he's wondering what we'd come up here for. Now, I says, Brother James, I guess you're wondering what we come up here for. Well, he says, I suppose since we haven't been to church and we're no good to the church, that you want us drop us from the church. And I said, no, that's not the case. I said, we come up here to find how you're getting along physically and financially. And I said, would you mind asking us a few questions? He said, we would not ask us a question we would not want to answer. I said, now, if we ask you any question that you don't want to answer, the easiest way out of that is just say it's none of your business. I said, we'll all understand. It won't hurt anybody's feelings. He said, you know, ask me a question I wouldn't want to answer. I said, well, the church is interested in how you get along financially and physically as well. I said, how much is your income? And they told us two small little checks that we're getting. And then about their income, about their expenses. And he didn't go very far with their apartment rent and the groceries and one thing or another, his expenses far above the income. I said, that brings up other questions. Where does the difference come from? Then he tells us a story about his doctor and the undertaker. And we got to know the undertaker by different funerals we'd had at this particular funeral home. So this Mr. Barbie, he said he felt it was going to be his lot to bury this old folks sometime. So he took out burial insurance on him himself and kept the payments up. So when James died, he paid off the payment for the funeral. And of course, he collected the insurance company for his expenses. So later on, Sister Jenny, she was forced to go stay with the niece. Well, the niece didn't take too good care of her somehow, that she felt that she needed more money. So she drew off the money that Mr. Barbie had allotted for her funeral, drew that off and used it up. So when she died, the church mainly paid for her funeral. But getting back a ways, when we went up there, when we brought this finding back to the church, and the church decided, since they had no one as relatives to take over, it would be the church's responsibility. So we set up a fund. We called it the Priest Fund for a long time, and people would contribute to that, and it was really surprising how much appreciation there was that a Primitive Baptist church would have a fund like this. We had outsiders, those pretty wealthy folks, as visitors to the church, would contribute as much as $100 on this fund at a time. So besides taking care of all of their expenses, this Brother Herman, the deacon, was one of the more active deacons. He took care of all of their expenses and kept this fund going. So the fund kept getting bigger after paying their expenses. So after they were both dead and gone, we didn't have restrooms on the church, so we used up the rest of that as putting down a well, putting on restrooms, and one thing or another to the church. So my son Alan, he said, Dad says you shouldn't close that thing out. So he started back up with another $500 gift. So we still have that fund for the poor still going at our little church. It's built up considerable since that time. This is just a few of the scattered highlights of our life. I know that's not very well arranged. It hadn't been written down or studied or rehearsed. It's just as I could remember a few of these things. But we have so much to be thankful for. The Lord has been so wonderful to us. We've been blessed with better health than average, good family, precious loved ones, kind friends, and a wonderful little church. And most of all, the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ that paid the penalty for undeserving, such as we know that we are. So we have so much to be thankful for. We've had this necessity of life, plus some luxuries to this time.